Here is Murray Stein, Jung's Treatment of Christianity, September 16, 1985, tape 1 of 2.
It's with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce Murray Stein to you tonight. Many of us have been very moved and influenced by some of the things that we have read by Murray Stein in the last number of years, and feel that he brings a very thoughtful and careful approach to his work. Murray Stein received his bachelor's and master's degrees at Yale University and his doctorate at the University of Chicago in the area of religion and psychological studies, which certainly relates to tonight's topic. He is a diplomate of the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich, and a member of the Chicago Society of Jungian Analysts, and is chairman of the Board of Trustees of the C.G. Jung Institute in Chicago. He said that he travels two or three times a year for talks such as this, and so we feel particularly honored and pleased to have him with us. He's been interested in the notion of Jungian approach to clinical practice, which is of interest to a lot of us in Seattle as well. And because of his interest, he, along with Nathan Schwartz, started a magazine called Chiron, and there are some brochures about it over on the table, should you be interested in that. So we know that he's not only a man with a vision, but a man with a practicality to carry out his vision and a commitment to do that. David and I stood at the airport tonight waiting for them to figure out how to get the stairs to reach the plane and mused about what this person looked like whom we had never met. You talk with a person on the phone, and you correspond with them, and you develop sort of an inner feeling about them or a picture, a general notion of them. And we decided that we didn't have a particular perspective in this case of a particular age or a particular body type. Sometimes we do pretty well about body types or things, but this time what really came out strongly was a feeling about a person with integrity, with thoughtfulness, and carefulness dedicated to his profession and his field. I feel that we've all benefited from the work that he's done to date and look forward to hearing him tonight.
Marla, usually people tell me that they expect to find somebody about 55 years old, about 5 feet 5, about 175 pounds, and bald. And I say, no, you're thinking of my friend Nathan Schwartz. I was talking to some people over the weekend about the subject of how they first came to read Jung, came upon Jung's works and writings, and they asked me my story, and I asked them their story. And it generally turns out to be one of those times that you remember very clearly, like where you were on the day that John Kennedy was assassinated, or, you know, one of those crystal clear moments in your life that's very memorable. And it reminded me of what a woman told me in Houston just after I got there from training in Zurich. And she told me how she had first come to Jung and what a difference Jung had made in her life since then. She said she had signed up to go to a women's luncheon meeting in Houston. And she got there and was surprised to find out that the C.G. Jung that was being presented was not about the new hotel that had just been established in New Orleans. It was instead about the Swiss psychiatrist, Jung. But she said her life really had not been the same since that day. And I think that is the experience of many people. Once they discover Jung, they become such a fascinating area of interest and study that one is really gripped by it and drawn into it, and indeed it does often have the effect of changing the course of a person's life. That was my experience when I first discovered Jung. I was in sort of the throes of a vocational crisis and didn't know what I really wanted to do, and rather typical of divinity students in my generation. And what Jung offered to me was the fascination of the unconscious. I'd never really thought about that before, and dream life and so on. The first work that I read of Jung's that I've read many times since, and is, in my mind, his greatest single work, is Memories, Dreams, Reflections, his autobiography. which wasn't actually even written by him. It was kind of ghosted by his personal secretary, Anila Yaffe. But I think of all of Jung's works, it is truly the classic of the lot, and probably will be the most enduring after hundreds of years have passed and Jung's theories have been thoroughly incorporated and modified and all the rest of it. I think just as a text of enduring interest and importance, it will stand the test of time, as probably very few books of the 20th century will. And one of the reasons that Jung appealed to me so much was that he was deeply concerned and interested in two areas that were also of interest to me: the areas of religion on the one side and the study of human nature and the human psyche and human imagination, thought, so on the other. And it's this combination that really originally fascinated me the most. It went way back into my adolescence when, indeed, my first experience of Jung was at about the age of 14 or 15 when I was walking through a public library in the city of Detroit and looking at the shelves and picking out this and that, and I picked a book off the shelf called Psychology and Religion by C.G. Jung. Took it home, thought, well, that's a very interesting subject, and I tried to read it and couldn't understand a word. Absolutely opaque to me. But nevertheless, it fascinated me. The subject fascinated me, and he talked about dreams and the unconscious and so on. I had no idea what that was all about. I did start reading Freud at about that time, and Freud was much easier to understand than Jung was. I think he still is. Much more accessible. But it took about another 10 years before I really plunged into Jung, and I've been reading Jung ever since. And I still continue to find many new things, many new insights, and new thought-provoking ideas and points of view in his works as I continue to study them and read them. And the book that I wrote, Jung's Treatment of Christianity, is really the fulfillment of a lifelong dream of mine to work on this subject of psychology and religion, try to bring the two areas together and try to understand how one impacts the other. It's really a study of two related questions. What did Jung say about Christianity, and why did he say what he did? Those are the two questions that I ask, and those are the two things that I want to touch on briefly tonight in my opening remarks, and then after the break we can discuss questions that you have, points that you would like to see further discussed. As I looked into Jung's life, and this is clear from his autobiography, his preoccupation with Christianity was a lifelong one. It started when he was a very small child. Some of his earliest memories have a religious import to them, a religious aspect. Figures like Jesus and a Jesuit and the image of God and the meaning of God and the meaning of various theological doctrines and so on preoccupied him as a young man in a very precocious manner, so that it's hard to believe that a 13 or 14-year-old boy would be so worried about the meaning of the doctrine of the Trinity or the nature of God, subjects like that. But it's quite understandable if you consider his family background, in that his father was a Swiss Protestant parson. About four or five of his uncles were also Swiss Protestant ministers, and his grandfather had been the Swiss equivalent of a bishop in the city of Basel. So he was surrounded by the Swiss Reformed Church and its ministerial representatives. I have a chapter in my book on this biographical relationship of Jung to Christianity, and I think it's a very important one for understanding his motives for dwelling at such length and with such intensity and depth on the subject of Christianity, really in the last 25 years of his life, when he took up the whole issue of Christianity and its present problems and its future as his final great task. And the way I look at what he did with the subject of Christianity is that he treated this religious tradition, his own, as he would a patient. He took Christianity into his practice, and he analyzed it in a therapeutic way with the hope that Christianity would, as a patient will, go through a transformation process and evolve into the next stage of its maturity and its quest for wholeness. I want to spell out a couple of the things that he felt Christianity needed to do in order to achieve greater wholeness. The topic of his lifelong interest in Christianity has its humorous aspects. And in the humor, there's often also a profundity. One of my interests is the religion of everyday life, the way in which religion is a part of our lives, woven into the fabric of our lives outside of our church experience, outside of official religion, where the religious factor enters life in a surprising way. And one of these moments that Jung relates in his autobiography occurred to him when he was about 10 years old. And as he looked back as an old man upon this event, he could see it in its psychological and psychiatric aspects, if you will, but he could also see it for its theological values. And this move of looking at the psyche in a theological way is one of the most interesting aspects of Jung's writings on psychology and religion. The story is that he was coming out of school one day when he was about 10 or 12 years old in Basel, and he came into the town square and he saw the cathedral of Basel. And it was a beautiful, bright, sunny day, and he looked at the cathedral. And this is the cathedral that was the seat where his grandfather, Preiswerk, the Antestes, the bishop of Basel, had presided. So there was an association in his family to this cathedral. It was the central focal point of Swiss religion in the city of Basel. And he looked at this cathedral and its spires up into the sky, and he saw the blue sky above the cathedral. And he looked up into the heavens and he imagined that he saw God above the cathedral sitting on his throne, and all was well with the world. God is in his heaven and all is well on earth. And then suddenly he felt an impulse to think a thought, to have a fantasy that he knew was a very bad thought, and that if he thought it through to the end, he probably would be damned for eternity, but his parents would be very upset knowing that he would have such a thought, and that he would disappoint them severely if he went to hell and didn't join them in heaven after life, and so on. So he was very frightened to continue the thought to the end, and he put it aside. He suppressed it. He banished it from consciousness. For 3 days and three nights, he sat on this intense inner struggle, and he tried to keep from thinking the thought. And finally, he couldn't resist it any longer, and he thought, well, come hell or high water, I've got to think it through to the end. So he went back into the fantasy and into the memory, and he saw himself in the town square and the cathedral before him, the spires and the sky above, and God sitting on his throne. And suddenly, as he allowed himself to think the thought through to the end, he saw coming out from under the throne an enormous turd, and it dropped from the throne of God and smashed the cathedral into 1,000 pieces. Now that scandalous and scatological thought was horrifying, of course, to the young boy, but Jung said it also provided him with his first experience of grace, that by allowing himself to think the thought through to the end, as bad and scandalous as it was, he experienced for the first time what grace was all about, the feeling of release and relief. And he really blamed God for making him think that thought. It was God's fault that he thought that thought. And that move of blaming God for your thoughts, I think, is a very important one. I'm going to want to emphasize that a bit as we go along. He also felt that that fantasy did have a theological meaning to it. And the meaning, in a nutshell, is that God was dissatisfied with his church. Okay? That God, there was a side of God that couldn't be contained in the Swiss Protestant church, and that would want to smash it. And this is what Jung called the dark side of God. It was a side of God that nobody would speak about, he said. All of his ministerial uncles and his father and his grandfather, none of them would talk about this side of God. And all they would talk about is the good God. And they would praise and glorify God in their churches and in their worship services. Nobody would talk about this fearful side of God that Jung felt was so important to address and so important to consider in one's contemplation of God. Theology is the logos of God, right? The words, the thoughts that we have about ultimate reality. And Jung felt that they have to include this dark side if theology is to be true. If the logos and thinking about God is to be true to reality, it's got to include this dark side, the destructive side of God. At one point, in answer to Job, one of Jung's late writings, he says, "We may love God, but we must fear him." And that was the sense that Jung had of God, that in addition to being a loving, almighty Father who intends well for his creation, there is a side of God that's also very treacherous and destructive, and one that one must fear and respect with a proper sense of awe and wonder and respect in the sense of respecting a very powerful destructive force. Now, in his later works on Christianity, Jung would want to include this dark side of God at the very heart of the doctrine of God. It was one of his objections to the Christian doctrine of God, to the Trinity, to the view of God as all good and only good. And Jung would want to bring this side of reality right into the center of the perception of what God is and what he intends. I want to consider for just a moment what some other interpreters have done with Jung and his writings on religion and Christianity, and give you just a thumbnail sketch of different approaches that have been taken. A lot of works have been written on the subject of Jung and religion, Jung and Christianity, theology, and so on. 1973, a Catholic theologian named James Heisig composed and published a critical bibliography of the works about Jung and religion. And at that time, in 1973, the number of entries that he cataloged in this critical bibliography numbered over 400. And those were mostly in English, with some German and French entries. And since that day, I would imagine that that number has tripled or quadrupled. So an enormous amount of time has been spent and ink spilled on the subject of trying to understand what was Jung doing with religion. Why was he so interested in it? What did he have to say about it? And what does it mean? And in doing the research for my book, I read through a good bit of this, not by any means all of it, all of this secondary material, but I read enough to get a pretty good sense of what's there. And I tried to categorize the approaches into four general types. And I think these four types include most, if not all, of the works that have been written on this subject. And I think each of the types has an image of Jung that it's working with, and I think each of the types is somewhat true and somewhat not complete enough, and that's why I felt there was a niche in the field for even one more work on this subject. Perhaps a rather unwise presumption at this point in the history of this field. The first group of people that I discuss in my book are those who saw Jung as mainly an empirical scientist, psychologist, who had made important discoveries about the nature of the human mind and how it works, and one who applied the discoveries that he made about the human psyche to the subject of religion. It's a question for some wonder if you ask yourself why what we call the originative psychologists of our century, Freud, Jung, William James, and others, psychologists in the secular discipline of the social sciences, psychology, psychiatry, would have spent so much time, so much of their valuable professional energy on the subject of religion. What does that have to do with the social sciences? Why was that so fascinating to them? In all cases, it had something to do with their own biographies. There always was a personal motive. And in the case of Freud, this motive has been explored and to some extent uncovered in a number of very interesting books, one of which is called From Oedipus to Moses, Freud's Jewish Identity, by an author named Martha Robert. Another work of interest is The Ordeal of Civility by a man named Cudahy, who makes a sociological analysis of Freud's theory in terms of Freud's Jewish identity. And so I tried to do something like that in a chapter on Jung and Christianity as well. I think there are important personal reasons why Jung studied Christianity. So I felt it was probably off the mark to think of Jung simply as a disinterested scientist who was taking a scientific theory and in an emotionally neutral way applying that theory to something as emotionally loaded as his own religious background tradition. And indeed, this turns out to be the case. If you really look at attempts that have been made by others to use Jung's psychology as a science in order to analyze religious doctrines, religious thought, whether in a critical way, positive, or in a negative way, generally those efforts don't seem to succeed very well. And this was really proved most dramatically, I think, when Victor White attempted a collaboration with Jung in order to use Jung's psychology to bolster his Christian faith. Victor White was a Dominican priest who was committed to a pretty much orthodox Roman Catholic position on doctrine and practice of Christianity. And what Victor White felt was that with Jung's psychology, one could show how Christian doctrines such as the Incarnation and the Trinity and the doctrine of Christ and so on were rooted in the archetypal dimensions of the human psyche. And so he felt that one could use psychology as a kind of handmaiden of theology in order to validate, so to speak, the doctrines of Christianity. If you could show that the doctrines of Christianity are both an expression of the fundamental building blocks of human nature, of the human psyche, the archetypes, as Jung called them, and you could show that Christian doctrine is indeed supported by these basic patterns of thought and behavior, doesn't necessarily prove their truth, but it does prove their authenticity in terms of human nature. That is, that Christian doctrine is not false to human nature, does not distort human nature, and indeed it can be used to enhance healthy human functioning. And Victor White wrote two books along these lines, using Jung's theories to kind of support and bolster his commitments to traditional Christian belief and practice. One of them is called God and the Unconscious, and the other, which is really the more mature work, is called Psyche and Soul. And he builds bridges back and forth between Christian doctrine and analytical psychology. Now, he and Jung came to a severe disagreement about this project. They started off with high hopes, and Jung thought he'd really finally found a theologian who understood him, and Victor White really felt that he'd found a psychology that would support his theological enterprises. And they went along this path for a while, and finally they had a falling out, a disagreement. They couldn't understand each other anymore after a certain point. And Victor White ended up saying that Jung was an amateur theologian, a naive philosopher, and he really didn't know what the Trinity was all about, and he really didn't understand the doctrine of evil and the privatio boni and all these things that Jung is always belaboring. And Jung came back and said Victor White just couldn't understand the psychological argument. So they were ships passing in the night, and obviously their projects were not on the same course. And there was a misunderstanding at the beginning, and finally, as it came out in the wash, they had to go their separate ways. And I think that generally happens with people who try to use Jung as a scientist, as an empirical scientist, to bolster their belief systems. And where Christians have generally run into difficulties with Jung is where he criticizes Christian doctrine. In other words, he doesn't just analyze it. He doesn't just say that the Trinity is based on archetypal structures and here's what those archetypal structures are. He does that, but then he goes on to say, but Christian doctrine is partial. There's something wrong with it. There's a critique, and he wants it to change. He wants something to be added. He wants something different. And this is where the theologians have always had difficulties with him. What's he doing saying that? He's not a theologian. He's a social scientist. He's got no business making recommendations to us for us to change our belief system, our practices. So treating Jung purely as a scientist doesn't really work out. There's another group of authors who I call the hermeneutical revitalists, a mouthful of words. What it means is that these people see Jung himself, or they see within his works the possibility of revitalizing Christian tradition, bringing it back by reinterpreting it in modern terminology. I call them revitalists. They want to revitalize the old tradition. They don't want to change it. They want to bring it back. And they do this through a method of interpretation. They use Jungian psychology to reinterpret the old doctrines, that's hermeneutics, in such a way that they have more meaning for modern men and women. Now, examples of this, and I think some of these books are very successful, but I don't think this is what Jung was primarily interested in doing. He did some of this, just like he did some of the science, but ultimately this isn't what his work was about. Some of the people who've done this most successfully are people like John Sanford, for example, who, in a book like, what's the name of it on the parables? The Kingdom Within, takes the stories about Jesus and his parables and interprets them in psychological language. So you have the story of the Good Samaritan reinterpreted in terminology that a modern psychologically sophisticated person can appropriate, can understand the meaning of the gospel in a new way, in a way that has much more inner significance. And so the old stories speak to us in a new way. That's what hermeneutics is supposed to do. It's supposed to take old texts and make them relevant to modern people by what is a shepherd? You know, what are the sheep? We aren't talking about literally sheep and shepherds. It's a metaphorical language, and we can reinterpret that in psychological understanding, using psychological understandings. And I think John Sanford's done a marvelous job. I like those books. I recommend them to people. And they're very helpful for people who really don't want to have their religious tradition critiqued particularly, but would like some added meaning and insight. And it really gives them something to chew on and to feed on. So I don't want to criticize that work, but I do think that it is not what Jung was doing, again, largely because of the critical element in Jung's thought, that he did that, and he did believe that Christianity had lost its symbolic punch, that the Christian symbols no longer spoke very powerfully, very meaningfully to modern men and women. Symbols like the Trinity, for example, or the cross, the Christmas tree even. Jung said, people put up a Christmas tree, they don't understand what that means, it's just a habit. But if you really understand the symbolic value of that, then putting up the Christmas tree is a much richer experience. So going to church can be a much richer experience. Meditating on Christ on the cross can be a much richer experience if you see that as a symbol of individuation. Crucified on the, stretched out on the opposites and so on, and as a symbol that speaks to all of us and to our suffering. So there is a side of Jung that lends itself genuinely and legitimately to this enterprise, but it doesn't take into account the critique that Jung launched against traditional Christian doctrine. A third group, and a much smaller one, sees Jung primarily as a physician, not so much a disinterested scientist, not so much a hermeneutical revitalist, but as a physician. That is, somebody who was concerned, as a physician is, with the health of modern men and women, with their psychological health and well-being. And so the reason then Jung wrote so much about Christianity and was so interested in that subject was that so many of his patients were suffering from suffering neurotic splits and so on as a result of their appropriation of Christian belief, that there was something unhealthy about the way Christianity was structured and impacted individuals. Okay, so if we can change Christian doctrine around a little bit, then the people who participate in the Christian religion will be healthier. If we can make the doctrine healthier, the people will become healthier. And this sees Jung primarily as a physician interested in these patients who are coming to him with complaints that their religion has crippled them. And so he's going to try to make the religion a little more healthy-minded. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, and I think they're right in seeing Jung primarily as a physician, that that was the core of his identity, more than he was a scientist, more than he was a revitalist. He was fundamentally a doctor of souls, as he said, somebody who was really interested in the health of human beings. Where I think this is off the mark a bit, at least the writings that have been done along these lines, is that they tend to emphasize Jung's concern for individuals in his practice, and they underemphasize his concern with the tradition itself. In my interpretation, I do also see Jung primarily as a physician, but one who is concerned with the tradition, and not primarily with the individuals in his practice, but that he treats the tradition itself as he would a patient, and that he's interested in the future health of the tradition and its transformation. So this group, which is a rather small one, in the literature, I think is onto something, and basically its perceptions are right, but it's a little bit off the mark. The work that I wrote is, in a way, an extension of that idea, carrying it more toward, more in the direction of seeing Jung and the Christian tradition locked in a psychotherapeutic-like engagement with each other. And the fourth view, which I find very interesting, but again a bit off the mark, and all of these have something valuable to say about Jung, is to see Jung as a modern man in search of his soul. And that mainly what he was writing all these books about Christianity for, and the reason was that he was trying to work out his own problems. And that the function of these works really was like a self-therapy. He was healing himself. And the reason he had to heal himself was that he was a modern man. And he was a modern man in the sense that he had an emotional attachment and commitment to an outmoded religious tradition which he could not affirm wholeheartedly. He could no longer live in the myth and believe with any degree of conviction, believe the doctrine, believe in the doctrines of Christianity, doctrines like the virgin birth and the divinity of Christ and the resurrection and all of these the miracles and so on that are so difficult to accept if one is committed to a scientific worldview. But that he was emotionally attached to his religious background on the one hand, but he was intellectually committed to modernity on the other. And so he was caught in this tension that so many people since the early 19th century have been caught in. The war between religion and science and how to reconcile these two radically opposed ways of looking at truth and reality. And that Jung found an ingenious way of solving this puzzle because on the one hand he could repudiate the truth claims of traditional Christianity because he was a modern man and say there's nothing but symbols and so on. He wouldn't have to believe in any kind of literal or strict way, wouldn't have to live in the myth anymore, on the one hand, but he could reappropriate them through a reinterpretation of them along psychological lines in the other. On the other hand, so he could have his cake and eat it too. And this is the thesis of Peter Homans in his book, Jung in Context, where he sees this double movement in Jung's writings, repudiation on the one side and assimilation on the other. He repudiates the truth claims of Christian theology on the one side and assimilates them and holds them close to himself on the other side through the psychological interpretation of them. Well, I think we're as interesting and in many ways as accurate as that assessment of Jung is. I think it misses the mark in the sense that I think the issues that Jung raised with Christianity really had are much more important for Christianity and really are more directed toward Christianity and that religious tradition than seeing his writing strictly as an attempt at self-therapy would lead us to think. It's a view that's a little too solipsistic. It sees Jung too locked into his own struggles. And I think it underestimates Jung's object relatedness and his maturity. I think Jung was really very much engaged in the problems of his age, of his culture, of his times, and of his religious heritage and background, that he really cared about it. And this view would have us believe that he didn't really care about it, that he was using it to his own narcissistic, if you will, ends. The discussion of that would lead us into all kinds of subtleties. Maybe we can talk about it some more if you'd like to in the discussion period. It's a very complicated and interesting thesis, as are all of these. And if you're interested in following up on them, also you could look in my book and look up some of the references that I have to each of these kinds of interpretation there. Now I'd like to spend the rest of my comments talking about Jung's critique. And Jung's critique of Christian doctrine. And I want to start out by saying that by critique, I don't mean attack. And I don't mean a critique in the sense that Jung is going to say that Christian doctrine is all wet or wrong or off the mark, any more than a therapist would say that about a patient who comes into therapy. If you imagine a therapist writing up a case report of his work with a patient, probably he would see that he would say that the patient had certain problems, right? That the patient comes in with certain needs. But he also assesses the strengths of the patient, that the development of the patient to the present does have its values. It isn't all off the mark. It isn't all inauthentic. It isn't all nonsense, craziness, usually. But it's one-sided. It has its problems. The patient is stuck. The patient needs something. Patient's unconscious will compensate for the one-sidedness. So the dreams are interpreted along those lines, that what the patient needs is in the self and will come forward in the course of an analytic process. And so the patient will perhaps go through a transformation process and come out more whole, more integrated, better off, less one-sided, and so on at the end of the process than at the beginning. And it's in that sense that the therapist would criticize a patient's mental universe and patient's thoughts and attitudes. And that's the way Jung's critique of Christianity is, that he does criticize it, but he also says it has its value, it has its strengths. It served a tremendous function in the history of Western culture, but it hasn't gone far enough. It needs to take another step. It needs to evolve some more. Just like a patient in the second half of life needs to integrate the inferior functions, bring back the repressed, integrate the shadow, that sort of thing. That's the kind of critique that Jung makes of Christianity. For example, he will say that Christ is indeed a genuine representation of the self. Okay? It's like Christ is a self symbol. But, he will say, he's not a complete self symbol. Right? The image of Christ in Christian thought and imagination, iconography, is partial because it leaves out the dark side. Christ is all light. He's all spiritual. He's all identified with the heavens and with the Father. He was born of a virgin. There isn't enough dark, enough earth in Christ. So Christ is a genuine symbol of the self, but he's partial. And he would say the same thing about the Trinity. The Trinity is a genuine working out is the elaboration, the intellectual elaboration of a genuine perception of reality. It's a truth. Okay, it's based on an archetypal foundation. And the theologians who worked out the doctrine of the Trinity weren't just spinning stuff out of nowhere. They weren't just making up a lot of words and putting them together with no basis in reality at all. No, it was a truth. And it is based on archetypal foundations. And one can amplify the Trinity with many examples from around the world. There are many other triads and trinities in the history of religions. So it is a genuine theological perception of reality, but it's partial. It leaves out something. So Jung will always ask, where's the fourth? There's a missing element in the doctrine of the Trinity, the missing fourth. And that's what I mean by Jung's critique. He's always asking what's missing, what's wrong, what's not there yet, what needs to be added. And what needs to be added in order for Christian doctrine to be a closer, even closer approximation to fullness and totality and wholeness. That's where he's headed. He wants Christian doctrine to be a fuller expression of reality. And he sees primarily two problems, two main deficits in Christian doctrine, the Christian doctrine of God primarily. One we call the problem of evil, or the missing element of evil, and the other is the problem of the feminine, that the feminine isn't included within the doctrine of God. I want to just say a few words about each of these. When Jung had that experience of God above his cathedral and smashing the cathedral, he felt that that was a genuine religious revelation. That was a revelatory experience. Jung felt that that revelation didn't stop with the closing of the canon in the second or third century of the Book of Revelation. That's it. Revelation continues. Right? Why should those people have had revelatory experiences and not us? So Jung believed that revelation continues, and we all have access to revelation. It may appear to us in strange forms, it needs to be interpreted, but we're all open to an ongoing process of God's revelation. Okay, and that can come in these peculiar ways, like the experience of God smashing his cathedral. And the perception that Jung felt was becoming increasingly evident to modern men and women, excuse me for the sexist language, that's a reference to one of Jung's works, Modern Man in Search of His Soul, you know. But the perception of God that's becoming increasingly evident is of his dark side, of evil, okay? And that this dark side of God is being experienced in many ways in culture and by individuals, and it needs to be recognized as a revelation. In such experiences as God smashing his cathedral. The theologically minded person would say, well, that is a perception of God dissatisfied with the narrowness of Christianity's understanding of what God is about. Christianity's God is too narrow. It's too small. The Christian tradition, as all religious traditions do, has put the reality of God in a too small box. And so God is breaking out of the box. God isn't a Christian, as somebody said in a seminar the other day. God's not a Christian. And he wants Christianity to open up the box, to see him more fully, to see it more fully. Maybe it isn't a him at all. To open the doors of perception and to let revelation happen. And let's expand the ways that every bowl of soup has a hair in it. There's always something wrong. And that bit of imperfection and wrongness belongs. That's a part of totality and completeness. It has to be imperfect, right? That's the way reality is. And the whole person is one who can hold the perception of reality in all of its complexity, good and bad and imperfect and spiritual and physical and all that, can hold that totality within consciousness and not split off. Either in relation to oneself or to other persons or to reality as such, that there is this capacity to be conscious of objects, self and other, in their complexity and their wholeness. So insofar as Emerson would share that, I think they probably would have a lot to talk about. Maybe one more back there.
Yeah.
Yes. That is a very big question, and I'm not going to give you a complete answer to it. I would recommend that you read his work, Answer to Job. In Answer to Job, Jung interprets the whole Bible from the beginning, from Genesis and the story of the Garden of Eden, all the way through the book of Revelations, through modern times and into the future. It's an enormous sweep. So he does interpret all the biblical themes, the fall of man, sin, redemption, all of that, the need for Christ, Christ representing the incarnation of God, and the reason that Christ was necessary to redeem man, and so on and so forth. I'll leave that to you, and you can read it and study it. It's a very complicated story. But I think, just in a nutshell, Jung felt about Christ, the image of Christ, as it has been established doctrinally in the history of Christian thought now, which is different from the figure of Jesus of Nazareth in the Gospels. There's a difference between the Christ of Christian doctrine and that figure of the teacher, Jesus of Nazareth, and what happened to him, the stories about him, and so on. But what Jung felt about the Christ of Christian doctrine, as it was elaborated in the early centuries of Christian thinking, is that it is indeed a symbol of the self, of wholeness, completeness, and totality, and so on, what Jung called the self. It is a true symbol of the self, as he says, in a number of places, but it's partial. And you always have to keep both of those things in mind when you try to understand Jung's attitude toward Christian doctrine. It's true, and it's valid, and it serves a positive function in the history of consciousness and religious awareness, but it's partial because it leaves out something. And what it leaves out, he says, is the dark side, the shadow brother. Okay, so that as the doctrine of Christ was elaborated, it was split off and attached, so to speak, to the spiritual dimension, the Father and Son and Holy Spirit over here. And over here is evil, Satan, the Antichrist, so on. Now what Christian doctrine did with that aspect, that split off aspect, evil, Satan, so on, is a rather complex matter. And one of the axes that Jung grinds over and over and exercises him no end, and he gets very emotional and upset about it, is the Christian doctrine of privatio boni, as he calls it. Privatio boni says that God is all good, okay, and God is complete reality, which Jung would want to agree with. God is complete reality, but he wouldn't say God is all good. God is all good, God is complete reality, and what evil is non-existent. It's the privation of good. It's the absence of good. So it's a definition of darkness in terms of the absence of light. That drove Jung up the wall. He couldn't understand how it was such an obvious dodge. Okay, if you look at that as a psychologist would look at somebody's thinking, it's obviously a defense, right? It's an elaborate thought process that is in the service of some other agenda, okay? And that other agenda was to keep God pure and light and good, while at the same time saying God is everything, God is totality. And you can't have those two things at the same time, Jung would say. You can't have your cake and eat it too. So you've got to include the reality of evil in the doctrine of God if you're going to say that God is totality, God is reality as such. You've got to put evil in there somewhere. And Jung would say you've got to put it in the center. Somebody at one of these, I've been at on this tour for 2 or 3 days now, and I get the various places mixed up. If this is Tuesday, it must be Belgium, sort of thing. Somebody said, if God is also evil, How can we pray to him? And if you think about that, it is kind of a frightening prospect. How can you pray to a God who includes darkness and evil within his or her being? And I think that was a very good religious perception. That's like one of those questions, how do you know that God exists? How can you pray to that kind of God? It's very fundamental. And I think Jung's answer to that, as I said earlier in my talk, was we can love God, but we must fear him. Okay, that there is a different sense of what God is and this vision of the doctrine of God, and that God is a mixed bag, okay? And there is a sense of awe and fear that really is kind of primitive. Jung would go back to the primitives, maybe more of an Old Testament sense of God, as also thunder and lightning and emotionality and the difficult side of human experience also is reflected in that. Yes.
Could it be, I don't know if Jung ever addressed this, could it be that maybe the concept of good and evil don't really apply to God, being more something that is just remarkable, you might have that this is bad, yes. Like this happened.
Right. Yes.
Maybe that's not a consideration.
Yes, and Jung did address that point. That he said good and evil really are human definitions. Depends on what we like and what we don't like. And he really was trying to get beyond that to raise human consciousness to the point of beginning to be able to accept reality as such without having to divide it between good and evil. Now, whether the human being can reach that point is another question. Whether we can have a kind of consciousness that doesn't divide things into good and bad, can hold reality as such, just as is a real question. I don't know if we're able to do that or not. I'm going to take one more and then I'm going to stop. Back here, yes. Yes. Right. I think there it's an evolution of consciousness that's required, a development. It's a developmental sequence that Jung has in mind. And he certainly wouldn't say that children can reach this stage. You know, you have to learn the difference between good and evil before you can integrate or do what we're talking about. And he sees that as a developmental process. Just like he sees Christianity as part of a developmental process that has to evolve and one has to grow into the next stage of it. Jung had another revelation, if you will, in the form of a vision. I told you about the cathedral experience, and he would take that as a revelation of God, God's reality is destructive and the dark side and so on. When he was about 65 years old, he was studying the spiritual exercises of Saint Ignatius Loyola intensely, and he was giving lectures at the university on active imagination and these meditation exercises that are traditional in the Jesuit order particularly, and comparing them, contrasting them. So he was very engaged in the subject of Christian doctrine, and in the Ignatian exercises one goes through a systematic series of meditations on the life of Christ. Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, Christ on the cross, so on and so forth. And one puts oneself into those situations and imagines them with all the sensuous detail that one could muster and then reflects on it theologically and so on. And he was contrasting that to active imagination, which is more spontaneous and less organized, less planned, so on and so forth. And while he was engaged in this intensive study, he said he woke up in the middle of the night and he had a vision. He said this wasn't uncommon for me. It didn't upset me overly much. So I just let myself experience it. What I saw was an image of Christ about life size at the foot of my bed. and he was colored green and gold, golden, sort of a combination of colors like that. And I simply watched this, and it faded after a while, and then the next day I reflected on the meaning of that. And then he comments on how he understood the meaning of that. And he says, I wondered why I had that image come to me. Did it mean that the unconscious was giving me something that I, some part of Christian tradition that I hadn't yet lived up to or actualized in my own life, that I hadn't realized the full value of the potential for consciousness and growth and development within Christianity, and therefore I am presented with this image of Christ. In other words, the idea is that the unconscious will give you what you need for the next step of your conscious development. So he asked himself, maybe I haven't attained the fullness of the Christian development yet. And that's the meaning of this vision. And then, somewhat grandiosely, he said, no, I didn't think that's what it was. And the reason is that not only had I attained the level that Christianity espouses of spiritual development and so on, but the color was green and golden. Why that color? And then he related that to alchemy. And associated that image of Christ with what the alchemists called the filius philosophorum, the son of the philosophers, which is, Jung said, a response on the part of nature to the spiritual Christ. So the mother will answer the father, so to speak, by producing another image of a son. And these two sons have to come to terms with each other, the son of nature, the human nature, so to speak, the image of the human being as natural, of the earth, of the mother, and the image of the human being as of the father and the spiritual being. And these two brothers have to come together in some form. And so it's the unconscious presenting a compensating image for the traditional image of Christ in this. And that was the next stage of in his own development that he had to undertake. Now this idea of stages of consciousness is very important in Jung, and that's my long-winded way of answering your question. That Jung felt very strongly that the gains that Christianity had brought into the world in the way of a moral conscience, an ethical sense, okay, a spiritual development toward a strengthening of the spiritual side of human beings was exceedingly important, and really the condition for further development, that you had to reach that before you could go on and reconnect then back to nature. Okay, you had to make that development first and strengthen the spiritual side and the sense of good and evil and attach yourself firmly and strongly to that before you could afford to integrate evil. Otherwise, you'd simply fall into the dark side, or you wouldn't have the ability to make a distinction. So I think you would feel very strongly that it's important to instill Christian virtues and Christian values in one's youth and hold on to them in one's adulthood. It isn't a matter of letting those go or denying their value, but it's a matter of bringing what's been left out and unintegrated into the picture in a way that reorganizes the internal relations of the whole thing. That's what he means by transformation, that you bring what's been left out in, not just added to, but in such a way that the chemical combinations between the various bits and pieces of your structure form into a new pattern. But that comes about in stages. And so the Christian development is absolutely essential before the next bit of development can take place. Thank you very much.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.